Владимир Путин объявил, что нужен закон о российской
нации. Путин поддержал предложение провести год единства
России. Закон о российской нации может вырасти
из уже существующих. В стране появится закон о российской нации.
Русская или российская нация?
Люди самых разных национальностей.
Can you define a nation in a law? Владимир Путин seems to think you can. And this week, in advance of today's National Unity Day, he called on Russian lawmakers to do so. So what's behind the Kremlin leader's call for a law defining the Russian nation? Is it an appeal to civic patriotism? Is it a message to ethnic minorities that they need to assimilate into a larger Russian whole? Or is it an attempt to create a modern version of Homo Sovieticus, the new Soviet man? Whatever the case, Putin's appeal is the latest sign that the Kremlin is accelerating its ideological trajectory and its embrace of state nationalism. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior policy fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Happy Unity Day.
Happy Unity Day. And joining us via Skype from Moscow is journalist Anna Aratunyan, author of the book The Putin Mystique, Inside Russia's Power Cult. Welcome back, Anna.
Hi.
Hi.
Good
to see you again. So, in a column for Sloan this week, the prominent opposition journalist Oleg Kashin wrote that, and I'm quoting, "A nation created by a law, of course, will never come into being. Instead, it will be a political organization, albeit one including 100% of the population. In the Moscow Times, Alexander Verkhovsky, director of the Sova Center, wrote that, quote, "If there is a law on the Russian nation, it will almost certainly tie ethnicity in with national security issues. It will also continue the vague ideological quest that some have politely referred to as the ideology of new state nationalism." Mark, what do you see happening here?
Well, there's several points to make. One is exactly this is part and parcel of a general shift that we've seen for some time now, as Putin tries to adapt from a model of legitimation which is essentially technocratic. In other words, support me because of all the wonderful things I do for you, to a model that is much more personalistic and ideological. You know, support me because I'm a super person, but also because I am the avatar of some greater Russian nation destiny and so forth.
So we're talking about creating Homo Putinicus here.
Yeah, exactly. But of course, the interesting thing is, I mean, obviously all ideologies are created to some extent. But nonetheless, whether or not Putin has the ingredients necessary, because up to now he's very much been operating on an almost scrapbooking level, taking little bits and pieces as convenient without any kind of coherence. So maybe this is an attempt to try and bring that coherence. Second point they make, though, is interestingly enough, though, he didn't present this as a here is a law, here is a definition that we will now impose. He said it's really good to be starting a discussion on this. Now, I mean, this is interestingly ambivalent and indeed cautious. In fact, it's almost, and in thinking of Putin's sort of nemesis, it's almost Gorbachevian. Mm-hmm. Gorbachev would do this. He'd come up with a slogan and he'd throw it out to see how the discussion goes. And we know how well that went. so, I mean, it'll be quite interesting that, in a way, Putin is encouraging debate on some of the most potentially fractious and fissiparious issues around. And the final point I'd make is precisely a kind of connection to that. It is inevitable that Putin is going to have to disappoint some people. Either he's going to be going for a sort of inclusive, post-Soviet Homo Sovieticus, which is it's all about basically, you know, having the right passport, and it doesn't matter what your ethnicity is and your language is, as long as you get behind the sort of a great civic mission. Or it's going to be much, much more sort of crudely and banally Russian nationalistic. The latter, you might say, has more mobilizing power, but instinctively, automatically alienates at the very least the 20% or so Russians who are not ethnic Russians. While the former, it's all very well, but apart from further alienating the nationalists, it also lacks a very clear focus as to quite what it means.
I mean, couldn't he split the difference? I'm thinking of the Homo Sovieticus variant. I'm thinking of something that we are all part of this larger Russian whole, Rossianini, not Ruski whole, meaning Russian citizens. But you have to assimilate into the Russian whole and be part of the Russian whole.
Soviet model was definitely, again, it's part of this whole matryoshka, but except there was the overarching Soviet identity above that, which really did mean something. Mm. And that's not what Putin's got. I mean, anyway, the virtue from the Soviets' point of view is they had Soviet, they had Russian, and they had whatever your actual, right, written in your passport. Putin hasn't got the sort of the Soviet portmanteau. And the second point I'd make is, one thing I don't know if Putin fully appreciates is that ideologies are not just mobilizational tools, they're also limitations. Soviet ideology was not, even in the later years when, as it were, the Soviet ideologists were on the whole just simply, gosh, doesn't it sound familiar, pragmatic kleptocrats. But nonetheless, they were forced to an extent to play the game that was, mm-hmm, that was shaped by ideology. Ideology actually did provide constraints on the activities of the leadership. It'll be interesting to see how far Putin is willing to internalize that notion that if he is going to create a national idea, it also has to be something that constrains his own behavior.
Mm. Anna, your thoughts? You're sitting there in Moscow, unlike us. What does it look like from there?
Well, I'm frankly not liking this very much. I mean, this whole idea of creating an identity from the top. I think what this underlines, and this is a very worrying trend. Is that the Kremlin feels genuinely threatened by centrifugal forces, and it's kind of groping in the dark for ways to fight them. And the forces I think it feels threatened by are manifold. It's possibility of inter-ethnic conflict among the various ethnic nationalities. It's the possibility for separatism. And another big part of this centrifugal force is the lack of an identity among Russians themselves, a binding idea that would unite them. This vacuum is divisive. And it's not just a problem of ethnicity, it's more of a problem of lack of community. But strangely enough, I think that the most divisive, the most atomizing thing that can be done in this situation is to try to create an ideology from the top, which is going to be almost automatically rejected by Russians who feel that this is something being imposed upon them. And as we've seen from the responses to this law that, as you mentioned, Kasia, I've seen some nationalist responses who are already very aggressively opposed to something like this.
How is this playing with the ethnic minorities? Have you seen any indications of that? I understand the Tatars are a little upset about this.
I think everybody's going to be upset about this ultimately because in terms of ethnic minorities, I mean, it was already mentioned that based on the strategy they already have in use, what they mean to do is find ways to assimilate minorities into Russia. But how are they going to do that? And given that, previous efforts have been, kind of divisive at best, there's really, given that there's no plan to do this, of course they're going to be worried that this law is going to be taken as a signal to crack down on minorities instead of actually assimilating them.
Yeah, because one would think the elements of this are going to be Orthodox Christianity, the Russian language, and these are going to be divisive issues in ethnic minority populations like the Tatars, and in the North Caucasus. I was struck by, Anna, how you initially said this is almost like a defensive move by the Kremlin. They feel these centrifugal forces pulling apart, but I almost see it as a proactive move in this ideological turn that the Kremlin has clearly taken, and you see evidence of this all over the place, that they're moving in this ideological direction. Even in the shakeup in Putin's inner circle, to me, it's one of these things that illustrates a shift away from kind of kleptocratic Russia toward ideological Russia, as Mark would put it. Do you see a proactive element here? It's almost this effort to forge an ideology, not in a defensive sense, but in also more of an assertive sense.
In a way, yes, but I think it's both assertive and defensive. I think that it's almost the word I'm looking for. I don't want to overdo this, but it's a bit desperate. I mean, the analogy that comes to mind is that someone who has insulin resistance doesn't process sugar very well. is going to keep craving that sugar more and more of it, just because it's just not metabolizing correctly. And I think this is something similar. Russia doesn't have an idea of nationhood at the community level. That is a problem that the Kremlin keeps wanting. That's a vacuum the Kremlin keeps wanting to fill in order to stay in power, because it is a threat not just to society as a whole, but to the government that tries to keep it together. So it is proactive in the sense of, like, you know, creating something to work with maybe post Putin, but it is symptomatic, I think, of a larger identity crisis that permeates not just the government but society as a whole.
Mark, I see you writing, so you must be thinking.
Well, this whole defensive versus proactive dichotomy is an interesting one, and again, as ever, I'm going to try and sort of have my cake and eat it. In that, on the one level, of course, it is proactive. It is definitely, we have seen, since Putin returned to the presidency, he's not just simply been responding. He clearly is a different person from when he handed power to Medvedev in the first place. And he has, in the process, I think, wanted to abandon some of the old modes of legitimation. But, of course, at the same time, he's been forced to, I would say, maybe accelerate that pace. Because of the economic crisis that has sort of made it harder to be a technocratic legitimator. And at the same time, because he's been given opportunities like Crimea, which again allowed him to shift back to this heroic model of what it means. But I mean, the aggregate effect of that is that this is very, very opportunistic and piecemeal, and it's clearly not thought through. And it's not like I believe that Putin was being disingenuous when he started a debate. It's not like he has an answer in mind and he just wants to go through the pretense of some kind of a debate, because he's never, ever demonstrated
that. You don't think he has
an
answer in mind?
I mean, I think he probably has general thoughts or whatever, but I don't think he has a sort of a blueprint. It's not as if in his drawer he has the law he's planning on bringing out, because we've never seen that before. Putin is not one who calls for national debates just simply as a way of diffusing popular discussion. And instead, I think in part it does reflect this fact that on one level we see sort of Putin precisely returning to this Nicholas I model. Mm-hmm. But good old Nicholas I, I mean, what did he have as his pillars? You know, the same sort of things that Alexander later on, was Alexander III, later on, you know, orthodoxy, autocracy, nationalism. That has always historically been the sort of the basis, even if it's not been identified as such. Well, he can't really rely on orthodoxy if he doesn't want to alienate not just the Muslims and all the other sort of religious minorities, but there's also, you know, a fairly strong secularist strand still within Russian society. Nationalism, again, that's the whole point. What does nationalism mean? Sure, cream nash, great. But beyond that, what actually does it mean to be a nationalist Russian? Does it mean imperialism? Does it just simply mean proud in your own state? They haven't yet managed to define that in a way that sort of is satisfactory. And autocracy. Well, as we've seen with the Duma elections, Russians are under no illusions that they live in an autocracy. But that doesn't mean to say that they're happy being mobilized by that. They'll accept it because they have no choice, but they're not enthusiastic.
Do you see this as kind of continuity from the whole Krimnash movement, you know, the patriotism that was sparked from Crimea, or a break from that?
I think it's neither. I mean, I think it's not that it started with Krimnash. I mean, that was a historic opportunity that fell into Putin's lap. But I think even before that, I think really, I mean, putting aside how Putin himself had changed, I think Bolotnaya was significant in making him shift. Because, again, you know, something that we've said in the past, those who were protesting at Bolotnaya were in many ways Putin's children. They were very much the products of the old Putinism and its attempt at sort of finding a balance between technocracy, economic liberalization, and modernization. I think he's now realized that his support base, which once upon a time was in the cities and the advanced cities and the middle class, is actually now with the lumpen proletariat. And therefore, he's looking for different ways of reaching out to them. And this is how he sees it.
Mm-hmm. Anna, your thoughts on that?
I think there's one additional, it's a very important motivation behind something like this. And yes, I would agree that there was a major shift we saw after Bolotnaya. But even prior to that, there was a lot of, you spoke to security officers of various ranks, and I have an article coming out about this in ECFR. Security The security community in Russia was always very keen on a grand idea. They felt that was lacking. They felt that they couldn't really function without, you know, some kind of grand, almost divinely inspired purpose. And in the interviews I did prior to Bolotnaya, I mean, up until this new kind of ideological shift towards nationalism that we saw with Putin's return to the presidency in 2012, there was a clear demand for that. They wanted Putin to give them something, to tell them what to be and why to be. And they needed a mission statement, and Surkov's sovereign democracy just didn't really cut it, and Bolotnaya kind of showed that it was just too confusing, too arcane. They needed something clearer. Problem is, yes, I mean, the shift to nationalism was conveniently exemplified by first the Pussy Riot story, kind of, you know, by helping kind of cement church and state, recycling this idea of symphony between the church and the state. And then secondly, it was also conveniently bolstered by the Ukraine crisis, which kind of allowed the Kremlin to revive this Russian world idea. But again, I think these were opportunities. Now, I mean, in wake of all that, we're still left with an idea of nationalism that Putin has that is still essentially a vacuum. I'd even call it a singularity. It's kind of, they've got the kind of the general contours, but what it is inside, no one can really see. It's almost kind of a black hole, because generally speaking, I think things like this are not really defined in a presidential administration or defined from below.
Mark, you wanted to jump in.
Yeah, I mean, putting aside the fact that it's hard to think of any problem which a mission statement can fix, I mean, I definitely agree with the idea that Anna was putting forward about this notion of being driven by the security apparatus. And Anna, I mean, we've spoken off mic, and I know that you're going to be covering this in your ECFR piece. But it's really striking the extent to which the National Guard have brought in well-known conservative propagandist, ideologue, journalist Kinstein as their sort of new ideology chief. Now, it's interesting because the army has no ideology chief. The FSB, beyond building a couple of churches, has no ideology chief. It's the new National Guard, which is in some ways the agency that best exemplifies this current iteration of Putinism, which feels the need to actually have its own in-house ideologist.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. And I want to move on to this broader question of ideology, moving beyond this whole idea of the Russian nation into the ideology. But first, I wanted to make a link, a very important link, between the Russian nation, as Putin's talking about it in this new law, and Ruski Mir, the Russian world. Because I have a sneaking suspicion that this law, once it's written, is not just going to be exclusively about what's happening inside of Russia's current borders, but outside it as well. Do you see that element coming into, either of you see that element coming into it?
I don't really, in the sense that there is already a huge superstructure of laws and understandings to allow, in a way, Russia to usually artificially mobilize the notion of the Russians abroad as a casus belli, as a reason for intervention or whatever. And if anything, I think we've actually seen a bit of a shift back from that of late. Because let's be honest, the Russians abroad on the whole are not happy with the idea of being presented as Russia's fifth colonist. If you look at the Baltic states, for example, there's a definite blowback. And it's not just simply because the Baltic states governments themselves have been seeking to you know, make sure they have stronger relations. It's actually that a lot of Russophones and Russians who once upon a time were happy to mobilize that, we're hard done by, because that's how you get anything in a democratic society, is by complaining and finding a mobilizing cause. Suddenly now, when they're faced with the fact that it's not just simply a nice, safe mobilizing cause, but something that actually puts you in the front line of the sort of geopolitical struggle, thinking, whoa, no, we didn't mean it that much.
Right.
So, I mean, I'm not convinced that there's a particular appetite or reason to do that. But on the other hand, I mean, here I would agree, it's inevitable. As soon as you start getting, I mean, firstly, opening a debate on this, which again is, it's so, and I say this as a battle-scarred Brit still thinking of the Brexit vote, but, you know, opening a debate rather than just simply opposing things from above is clearly the worst thing you can possibly do. Joking apart, though, I mean, it is going to create all kind of, or liberate all kind of sometimes quite toxic views and emotions As we see this discussion in Russia, assuming it actually is a real discussion.
But you would disagree with Verkhovsky that it's going to have an explicitly move in this direction.
I don't think that's the intent. I think, you know, if anything, you know, it's quite interesting, actually, Putin's language very much framed it, I think, in much sort of broader and actually rather more bland terms. And of late, he has been toning down his rhetoric about this. So I don't think this is the intent. But again, this is where we come back to this point about ideology being a constraining factor. If you find that the debate is heading in a certain direction, if you find precisely that it begins to get hijacked by the more red, white and blue blooded toxic Russian nationalists, it might be that actually a sort of a certain pressure will generate that, even if it doesn't mean the Baltic states, might, for example, make it harder to disengage at all from the Donbass, for example.
Anna, what do you think? I think this is inevitably, Mark's right, is going to come into the discussion.
I would say probably not at this point. I think the time for, I mean, when the idea of the Russian world it was very big, when the idea of Novorossiya was very big. I mean, the quest for ideology essentially fused with that opportunity, and a lot of people kind of picked up on that. It really became, it struck a chord, it struck a social chord, this idea of unifying with the rest of the world. And it kind of waned because I think the Kremlin recognized the tactical constraints of that. I mean, if you're gonna set out and say that, what kind of implications is that going to have for what we're doing in East Ukraine, and then for what we're doing in other countries? I mean, I think there's a clear recognition that this is just unrealistic to pursue. And if we keep talking about it and not doing anything, it's going to alienate the kind of grassroots drive that supported the idea in the first place. I think this could come up again, but I think this is going to come up from below and not from above. I think the Kremlin is going to be more or less cautious about it. But I think these questions of this idea of the Russian world, it's going to be driven by the forces that have always been driving it, more grassroots, local, nationalist or imperialist groups.
But will they be able to avoid it, as Marx says? I mean, inevitably, there's going to be pressures here. If you start this discussion about the Russian nation, how do you not talk about the Russian world? I don't see how they avoid it.
Sir, but well, they can't. Eventually, they're going to come to this because eventually they're going to have to answer: is Russia really a nation? I would say it's not, and I think that most nationalists already recognize that it's not. But here's the collision that they're going to come up against. And I think this is a discussion and a thought process that is going to have to happen within the nationalist groups themselves, who are, I think, considering this a little bit more specifically than the Kremlin, with this more vague debate on nationhood. And the nationalists, I think, are going to come up against a contradiction. We're not a nation yet. To be a nation, we have to define what we are as a community. And that is, for now, we're going to have to set the idea of the Russian world aside. First, we're going to have to figure out who we are as Russians. And I've been seeing this a lot in the rhetoric of not just the nationalists, but like the more liberal nationalists, the more moderate mainstream, the likes of Navalny or Kashin. There's an increasing thought process about what are we? Let's stop talking about going abroad and doing things. We have to define who we are. And actually, Kashin stated this quite nicely, that there is, there's what the Kremlin is trying to define as a nation, and then there's like the real nation of Russians who have their own problems, who don't want to go and fight abroad. And so this is going to be a completely different type of debate. The debate we're going to see in the government is going to be completely alienated from the discussions we're going to see happening below.
What kind of reactions are you seeing in places like more like maverick nationalists like the Sputniki pogrom? Like, I'd be very interested in hearing what they are saying about this, and as well as the Orthodox Church. What kind of reactions are we seeing in those quarters?
Well, I'll just take one of my go-to nationalists who's just very articulate in terms of formulating this opposition, anti-Kremlin nationalist ideology. And this is Konstantin Krylov, who is a close ally of Igor Strelkov. And he recently wrote that this law is, it's not about, it's about taking Russians and creating something almost artificial out of them. Like, he's convinced that this is not going to this idea of a law on nations is not going to touch the migrants. It's going to concern and disenfranchise the Russians. The ethnic Russians that Krylov says the government is unhappy with. So now it's time to take them and remold them into something else. We don't know what, but the point is to remold them, to make them into something that they're not. And he sees this as part of a historic continuing trend that is symptomatic of the fact that we really do not have a nation.
Right. Okay. In order to segue into the second half, I wanted to kind of get back into the ideology, the ideological aspect of this ideological turn for a minute. In the second half, we're going to talk about the upcoming anniversary of the 1917 revolution, which I previously thought the Kremlin sees as a threat, but I'm increasingly thinking they see it also as an opportunity. Right now, there isn't anything close to a fully baked ideology floating around in Russia. You have this, as Mark, as you pointed out, this mishmash of neo-Stalinism, Orthodox Christianity, autocracy, nationalism. I mean, you have this mishmash of different things plucked from the past. Do they, can they fit into some kind of coherent whole? What are we going to see here?
No, they can't. I mean, I think this is the issue. Putin wants this whole mix and match buffet approach to fit together all the convenient bits or what he thinks of as the convenient bits and pieces. And although there are certain kind of overarching themes which are in common, which are, you know, invariably about the importance of the centralized state, the importance of a single national leader, and the importance of basically being united or else nasty foreigners will come and beat us, which are all issues which clearly make good sense to Putin, because they clearly all sort of support his mission. But exactly. But when you actually come down to it, Russians are no more sophisticated or stupid than anyone else. But on the other hand, what they have had is, or at least the sort of two-thirds or whatever who have experience of Soviet times, you know, experience of having lies and empty ideologies thrust down their throats and been forced to sort of pay lip service to them while not really believing them. And I think the problem is that, you see, the very fact that this is such an instrumental approach, the point at which you have to say, look, we need to create an ideology, is basically the point where you recognize you have no ideology. This is advertising. This is PR. This is social and political engineering rather than a real ideology, which is ultimately about belief. And, of course, it gets mobilized, it gets shaped and so forth. But basically, it's about some kind of underlying philosophical belief. Mm. Here, we're just looking at ways of packaging a bunch of politically convenient messages in a way that makes them look halfway coherent. And I really don't think that Putin's got that kind of PR skill. Mm.
You don't think that, like, Putin's respect for admiration of white philosophers like Ivan Ilyin plays into this at all? I
mean, but see, Ilyin at the same time was also very much opposed to the idea of a sort of authoritarian dictatorial state. I think actually there is no one.
I'm not sure I'd say that.
Well, I mean, Ilyin was definitely not some kind of neo-fascist philosopher. And in a way, really, what Putin is
looking for. I've heard him called that, to be honest.
Yeah, well, I disagree, and this is it. It's my day to stand up for
free
white
Ilyin.
But I think again, the point is that almost any properly constructed ideology carries with it some sense of the responsibilities and duties that go with power. That is one of the most absolutely fundamental things. And in a way, that is clearly one of the crucial elements that is lacking. Putin might sort of say, well, I'm doing it all in the name of the Russian state. But at the same time, he's also presiding over and indeed facilitating the massive embezzlement of that Russian state, which is clearly sort of antithetical to it. You know, this is what it comes down to. Ideologies are very rarely applied perfectly. But on the other hand, theoretically,
they have to hang together.
They have to hang together.
And there's nothing.
This is just simply what is going to be convenient.
Well, I think this is going to be interesting as we run into the 1917 anniversary, because I think this is when this is all going to come to a head. Anna, any last thoughts before we move on to that?
I completely agree with you. It is starkly terminal just how by saying we are in need of an idea of a law on the idea of nationhood, how much that says about its lack. That, I mean, once you have to say that, you're basically admitting to this gaping hole in your national community culture, and that's not something that can be filled by a government law. That's just it's going to be counterproductive. And I think that maybe, you know, I'm going to say something positive, because I started out saying how much I feel this is, I'm just not liking this at all. I think this might have a paradoxical effect by, you know, if this law is ever passed, it might just well be the last straw in this, you know, idea of even the ability to impose ideology from above. I mean, it might be like a wake-up call that, okay, we can't do it like this anymore. We've been, essentially, Russia's been doing it like this for
a thousand
years. It's like, maybe it's, and it's, right now it's like everybody's almost about to give up. The Kremlin is doing it half-heartedly. They don't really have, they've got this vacuous idea of what it is they're looking for. They don't really know what it is. They're just thinking, we've got to have something. And it's almost like in the terminal stages of this, you know, quest for a grand idea, right until the point where they decide, okay, maybe it's time to just abandon this quest and let it happen from below, from communities where it's supposed to be happening in the first place.
We'll introduce some irony before we move on. Russia could learn quite a bit from its neighbor to the south, because what's happened in Ukraine as a result of the conflict is that you genuinely do have, and you can't miss this when you go to Ukraine, the development of a civic nationalism that transcends ethnic nationalism, that transcends language. I mean, this is one of the biggest outcomes of the Ukraine conflict, and it did happen entirely and exclusively from below.
So you see, Putin can create ideology.
Yes, just elsewhere. Just elsewhere.
So on that different ways.
On that note, we'll move on. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and look at an important anniversary that the Kremlin sees as both a threat and an opportunity. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galeotti, a senior policy fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us via Skype from Moscow is journalist Anna Aratunyan, author of the book The Putin Mystique, Inside Russia's Power Cult. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfurl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Великая Октябрьская социалистическая революция.
В Петрограде началось восстание с выстрела на крейсере «Аврора».
Начало ликвидации капитализма и перехода к социализму.
А вся власть перешла советам.
Октябрьская революция оказала огромное революционное влияние на все.
The Kremlin has a 1917 problem, or a 2017 problem. Next week marks the 99th anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution, which means the centennial is just a year away. It's a milestone that Vladimir Putin's history-obsessed regime, which reveres the Soviet Union, could hardly ignore. But while the Kremlin is keen on reviving Soviet power, the last thing they want Russians thinking about is how the Soviet state actually came into existence in what was, in effect, the world's first colored revolution. And the Kremlin's wasting no time framing the anniversary. The Security Council this week began preparations to thwart attempts to, quote, falsify and distort the history of the revolution of 1917. Mark, how do you see the Kremlin framing this thing? This is going to get very, very interesting.
It is, because you said that the regime reveres the Soviet Union. Of course, it only actually reveres the middle bit of it. The latter stages, you know, late Brezhnev and Gorbachev, clearly they regard that as a cautionary tale of how you lose empire and strength. And, of course, Putin has made little mystery of his lack of sympathy with Lenin. It's really only with Stalin that we actually come into
right.
It. And so this is why 1917 is interesting. Now, I think particularly a couple other factors. One is, and I know this is my own hobby horse, but that the Communist Party, at least from the grassroots, has been showing a little bit more
life.
Willingness to be Bolshevik, life. And certainly in the last campaign, they campaigned on much, much stronger talking points. And I think in part as a result, if one looks at the analyses of the way the vote has been skewed since, I think they were punished by having more votes moved to the Liberal Democrats rather than letting the Communists sort of have their day. Again, I think that was an attempt to try and slightly marginalise them. And although Communist leader Zhuganov is hardly the sort of person to be raising the red flag and storming any barricades, I think he finds himself being pressed from below. So you have a Communist Party that really is going to expect to have its day. Yeah. And then you have a regime which, if we follow this ideological turn that we've been talking about, well, it's one thing to have a system in which parties have ideologies. If the state has an ideology, then any party that espouses a specific ideology that is different, like, oh, say, the Communist Party, mm-hmm. is actually by definition not just simply part of an opposition force. It is actually anti-government. It is, one could almost say, treasonous. We're likely to see less and less room for the communists. And so the question is whether or not actually Putin has decided to basically grab the opportunity to try and deliver some kind of knockout blow to the communists, rather than just kind of gritting his teeth or trying to turn 1917 celebrations into a celebration of change in Russia or something equally bland. He might actually be looking for it as an opportunity to basically break the communists.
Mm. Anna, what do you think?
I think this is a very difficult question for the Kremlin to deal with, because there's an inherent contradiction. On the one hand, if we look at Putin's attitude towards the Soviet Union, it's been generally positive. I mean, he did call it the breakup of the Soviet Union geopolitical catastrophe. And it's kind of hard in that context to outright vilify the founder of that, state. But he's done so. And not only that, I mean, we just saw the former Crimean prosecutor, Natalia Poklonska, the popular one who's now in the Duma, she called Lenin, alongside with Hitler, monsters of the 20th century.
And Zhirinovsky wants to rename Leninsky Prospect after Ivan Grozny.
Right. So, I mean, there is this backlash against Lenin, and yet Lenin is still in the mausoleum. I'm not really seeing him being taken out there, out of the mausoleum anytime soon.
I'm expecting it next year, to be honest.
Well, that would be actually a really good indicator of, you know, if they're going to do it, they should do it in 2017, and that's going to actually mean a great deal in the, you know, conversation we were having earlier about what is nation, what is Russia. I mean, this question has not been answered, and until they do, they're just not going to get very far in the quest for what we are as Russians. But I think generally, yes, where the revolution is concerned, there's this inherent contradiction. Revolution is bad, Soviet Union good. How do you get around this? I think they're going to play it both ways, as they've been doing now.
Well, I think an interesting thing that's going to come into this, and I'm really going to want to watch this to see how it plays out, is the role the whites are going to play in this whole drama. As we know, that they've been busy repatriating the remains of whites over the years. This is not something that's just happening now. It's an ongoing thing, including Ilyin, for example. Putin himself laid flowers on his grave. I'm hearing rumors, unconfirmed, but rumors that the descendants of some whites are going to be invited to take part in the anniversary commemorations. So, what does that mean? I mean, if I go back to my earlier comment that Putin does revere some of these white philosophers, is Putin going to go white and bury the reds and make that the ideology? I mean, is he going to be the great unifier of red and white and declare an end to the Russian Civil War, you know, 98 years after the fact, 100 years after the revolution? This is going to be something that's going to be very interesting to watch, because I do think they are planning something big for this. They can't ignore it. They don't want to appear on the defensive. And the way this regime acts when they're in this situation is they always take the initiative. So and there's signs of this. I mean, everything from the law on defining the Russian nation, from the Security Council calling for an end to falsification of the history of 1917, to things like Zhirinovsky, who's, let's face it, he telegraphs the Kremlin's message all the time as calling for Leninsky Prospect to be renamed after Ivan Grozny. I'm curious to see how the whites are going to play into this. Do either of you have any thoughts along those lines?
Well, I would just throw one thing. I mean, apart from, I'm not quite sure what scope there is to create a rapprochement and unite the reds and the whites. You end up with a kind of pink revolution. I think really the communists cannot and will not do that. I mean, Zhuganov might but I, perhaps, maybe, but even then he loses what minimal credibility he has left. But the thing is that the Communist Party is not just an ideological force. It's actually a political machine. It's the only political machine that remains outside the state's control. And that's something that in the past was much less of an issue because Yuganov and the whole Communist Party apparat were willing to play their role as the pretend opposition force. But if on one hand you've got the communists perhaps beginning or potentially just demonstrating that they could in the future actually be more of a meaningful opposition force, at the same time as you have this ideological turn, I think for me it says there is no room for a communist party or certainly not a communist party of the current sort of standing within the future Putin's Russia. And you might as well get it as it were buried with Lenin before 2018 in the presidential elections. Second thing is, I mean, it's not just about the whites. It's also about Nicholas II. Mm-hmm. I mean, putting aside just how fatuous the whole notion of sainthood for the guy may be. Nonetheless, you know, we have seen, and this is in fact the trigger for Poklonskaya's outburst. You know, we have seen, actually, I would say, a growing reverence for Tsarist era. We have Nicholas II, the sense of a sort of a, you know, a figurehead monarch who actually is meant to be the sort of heroic intercessionary between man and God. You also have, I mean, putting aside the fact that Nicholas II probably knew that he was going to be assassinated, Stalypin, the reformist prime minister, modernizer, whom we know Putin has a very great regard for, and that was instrumental in getting the Stalypin statue put outside the White House and so forth. You know, I think we have seen. Anyway, even before the much more immediate political, pragmatic reasons for doing something about the communists in 2017, we've seen actually quite a long-term build-up of a sense that, in fact, the real model is to be found. Not so much in Soviet times. I mean, in a way, you revere aspects of the Soviet system, but actually in Tsarist times. And I can't help but wonder if once upon a time Putin was willing to say that the collapse of the Soviet Union was the greatest geopolitical tragedy of the century, he might well actually be now be saying 1917 was.
Mm. Anna, would you agree with that?
It's a tricky question because, I mean, demographics is going to have to kind of play into this. I'm thinking, my instinct is that it's going to be hard for Putin to do something that's going to alienate the older, like, not politically, specifically politically speaking, the Communist Party itself, but its supporters. He's not going to want to aggravate them too much by vilifying the communists that much. So the question is this going to be a commemoration of something bad or a celebration of something good, or is it going to be something in between? And I think, I mean, it's going to be in his best interest to kind of play this in between because whatever his intent plans to bury the communists in some way or form, that's going to have to be very carefully thought out. And if I was doing this, I really wouldn't conflate it with, or try not to conflate it too much with the anniversary, because that might unleash forces that are going to they're going to get out of control really fast. I mean, such an emotional thing as this, it could actually backfire in terms of generating more support for communists, for the Communist Party, than less. So he's going to have to play it very carefully. And I think I would see this probably, again, as more of a mix of a commemoration rather than a celebration of revolution. Like, let's think deeply upon this terrible, and perhaps good and complicated thing that happened to us 100 years ago, and let's start a discussion, and let's talk about the whites, let's talk about the reds, let's talk about philosophy. I think that's how they're going to do it. I think that's really the only way there is to do it without setting off things they are not going to want to set off.
Anna, if you were in the big chair in the Kremlin, I have no doubt that that's how it would be done. But I just don't think that these people are anywhere near as restrained and reasonable as you are.
If I was being blackly cynical, I'd also suggest that the massive cuts to healthcare and social spending will also ensure that the communists' pensioner rump body will become increasingly less important, a force in the future as they just simply die off next time it's a cold winter.
That's a nice thought. I mean,
I like to bring joy and light wherever I go.
For a nice Friday afternoon. I mean, one thing that does give me pause on this, and Mark, I do think you're onto something here, but if they were going to bury the communists, why'd they let him come in second place in the Duma elections? I mean, it was looking like Zhirinovsky was going to come in second. A big deal was being made out of this. And why did they not bury them then?
I would suggest that one is, I mean, this, how far do you want to go in totally falsifying the results? It's one thing to actually sort of shave away the vote. It's another thing to actually reverse them round. Mm. And again, that actually might well have pushed the communists more and more quickly. I mean, the state will obviously, or the Kremlin will want to retain the initiative. It wants to pick when the fight's going to happen and how. By simply making it neck and neck, they actually were essentially making a warning point.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, secondly, look, they're not going to just completely sort of say, okay, if you're a communist, you're now a renegade and we'll drag you off to a gulag. You know, I expect what we'll see is encouragement of, for example, you know, some kind of major fractional schism within the communists, which is a kind of classic way of weakening them and sort of relegating them. But thirdly, look, Zhirinovsky, I mean, on the one level, he is tremendously useful and always sort of does the right thing eventually, but he's also a pain in the backside to manage, and therefore I think making him leader of the second party,
you mean Zhuganov,
Zhirinovsky.
Uh-huh.
No, I mean, so actually, you know, elevating him to being essentially the de facto opposition leader
would have been a problem.
You know, Zhuganov is safe. It's the Communist Party which is the problem. Liberal Democratic Party is safe. It's Zhirinovsky that is the problem.
And Zhirinovsky's behavior after the Duma elections was interesting. He had a rant in the Duma about falsifications, if you remember that, which he concluded with, Ya vas ninavizhu, I hate you. And then days later, he's accepting a state award and practically proclaiming Putin Tsar Vladimir I. So his behavior has been very interesting. And this leads me to the topic I wanted to kind of close it all out on. The commemorations of 1917 in November of next year come 4 months before what? The presidential elections. And a lot of this is, I mean, this is going to be, you can't separate this from the campaign to keep Putin in the Kremlin for at least another term, if not indefinitely. I'm wondering if we're going to see some kind of permanent change in the way, in the formal way that Russia's governed around this time. There's been rumors of a creation of a state council with Putin as its head. And maybe that this may be the last presidential election we ever see. Now, I'm speculating upon speculation, but I'm not the only one. How do you think this plays into the whole Putin campaign? Is 1917 going to be the kickoff of the veneration and coronation of Putin?
I mean, my view is that I think actually Putin, whatever else one say about him, does tend to stick to the appearances of legal forms. And I can't see what he benefits by actually dramatically reshaping the political system. At the moment, yeah, so he has the kind of supermajority that means he could initiate...
He could do that within the law,
constitutional change, exactly. But I mean, but without a constitutional change that would, for example, relax term limits. So all he has to do is, every few years, submit himself to re-election. Unlike the Duma elections, presidential elections are no great hassle. If anything, I would see the problematic point actually is the Duma. Not because the Duma votes against him or whatever. Of course, it's all thoroughly compliant. But actually, the Duma elections are inconvenient and expensive, and they always carry the risk of problematic results. And you then also have to, unlike the presidential elections, massively rig them. So I can't see why. I mean, it might be that his vanity would imply it, and obviously there are those around him who feel he ought to be sort of president for life or Tsar Vladimir the whatever or whatever. But I don't see that as being his thing. I don't see anything there, because even if there was some kind of state council, it has to claim its legitimacy from somewhere.
Yeah,
it has to be elected by someone. And so you're back to the same thing. The issue is actually that Putin has the personal legitimacy as the avatar of Russia. Unfortunately, he needs some kind of other supplementary constitutional structure. And whether it's a Duma, whether it's a Supreme Council, whether it's a High Junta or the Ecclesiastic Church, you know, it will have to be something which automatically is going to be problematic. I think the temptation would be to find ways of streamlining the Duma process rather than anything else.
So you would think that the 1917 thing would just be part of the whole general PR campaign running into 2018, because you can't separate these things. You just can't.
No, absolutely. But the point is, if you use that also as a chance to nobble and demonize the communists, and also as a chance to sort of build this kind of glorious ideological basis for Putin's claim to be the representative of the Russian people, then absolutely, then 1917 is just simply the kickoff to the presidential campaign.
Anna, your thoughts?
I think there's an inherent paradox here in terms of if we're looking at Putin doing away with elections and coming up with some kind of mandate at either a czar or emperor or, you know, high priest or I don't know what. I mean, as Mark said, there's going to have to be some heavy duty mandate there, like some sort of, I don't know, divine intervention or, I don't know, a very strongly worded document from the church or whatnot. The point is, I think the reason why Putin would not go for this is whatever this mandate is and however it is it's worded and however it's rationalized, it would put constraints on him. And it might actually put more constraints on him than the kind of hybrid democracy, hybrid autocracy that he's currently working with now, where, yes, on paper we've got elections and we can, of course, meddle in them and manipulate them any which way we want. And that actually leaves him a great deal of leeway to do as he pleases while maintaining a certain charade. I think if he was emperor or czar, he'd have to conform to something bigger than himself to a larger extent than he's doing now. And I think he's reluctant to do that.
Now, I suspect you're both right, but I'm not ruling out the other possibility. Something in me is expecting something big next year as we approach this anniversary. It's too big not to yield something big. And I think you're probably right. But I'm not 100% sure. So.
But I think, I mean, declaring war on the Communist Party, I think that's pretty big.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's not the same as declaring yourself emperor.
Well, okay. If that's your benchmark, then most
I got high standards. Any last thoughts before we wrap it up for the week?
I mean, whenever we've seen major ideological change in Russia, it's been, yes, from above, and B, accompanied by obscene amounts of violence. Whether we're talking about, obviously, the Bolshevik Revolution and the subsequent civil war, but even if we go back to Prince Vladimir of Kiev bringing Christianity by toppling the pagan idols into the river and then marching at spear point his people into the river to be forcibly baptized. I think whenever we've seen major changes, it's been involved with violence. The thing is, I don't see the current Russian state trying to have that kind of violence or looking for it or necessarily being that comfortable mobilizing it. So again, I think this is why we might like to see expect these huge changes. I can't help but wonder if all of this discussion apart, they're going to flinch at the final moment. So it's just business as normal.
Just another PR campaign.
Well, no, I mean, I think they plan something big, but whether they'll have the nerve to go through with it, that'll be interesting.
Anna?
That Putin right now doesn't know. He has a tendency to come up with these things at the last minute, especially difficult decisions like this. And I think he's sitting around right now. He has throwing around various ideas in his brain. No one knows what they are. Maybe they'll ask him. People are going to obviously pestering him with, here, why don't we do this or that? And he's like, oh, he's just sitting on all of this, sitting on a number of fences. We'll hear of his decision at the very last minute. I think it'll be a surprise for everybody, as it usually is. And everything that we've said, somebody will say, "Oh, something I said, I don't know, 3 months ago, and he's done that." Somebody else will say, "No, he listened to me," and it'll be just one big crowd pleaser.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that
suspense kind of coming.
That there's little doubt about. On that note, we'll wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior policy fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us via Skype from Moscow has been journalist Anna Aritoryan, author of the book The Putin Mystique, Inside Russia's Power Cult. Thank you both for an enlightening and interesting discussion.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.